Welcome to The Program, a podcast dedicated to exposing the institutional child abuse that occurred at the hands of WASP, or Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs, an organization that owned a network of dozens of schools that systemically abused at-risk teens and exploited their parents for millions of dollars. This podcast aims to expose those responsible and seek justice for the damage caused to the innocent children who endured unspeakable abuse. This podcast is for the survivors. I dedicate this to you. Welcome back, you guys, to another episode of Inside the Program. This is your host, Caroline Lorson, and today I've got a magical little episode that I hope leaves you feeling understood and supported in every way. If you are not a survivor, I hope this episode will help connect some dots on how the techniques used in these programs can create some serious psychological repercussions. Our guest, Rachel Bernstein, is a licensed marriage and family therapist who delved into the world of cult recovery after a family member almost succumbed to the seductive and manipulative world of Scientology. She has over 27 years of experience in working with victims of cults and emotional abusers. I truly wish we would have had hours to talk, as I have an endless list of questions for Rachel, but this episode is really phenomenal. I know that you're going to love it. Rachel shares with us the top characteristics of cults, why they are so effective, and how they are incredibly similar to the indoctrination and thought reform or behavior modification that took place in the WASP programs and other facilities that use similar modalities. Rachel has an impressive history of published articles, TV appearances, and most recently was featured in the new docu-series Seduced that uncovers the stories of the victims of the cult Nexium. Rachel is also the host of the incredible podcast Indoctrination, which is a weekly podcast covering cults, manipulators, and how to protect yourself from systems of control. Rachel says she wanted to start a show that gives survivors a chance to tell their stories and for experts to teach us what they know. Her goal for Indoctrination is to empower listeners to protect themselves and those they love from predators, toxic personalities, and destructive organizations. There's a link to her podcast below. Go show her some love. And after you're done listening to this episode, go get lost in all of the amazing information that she provides in Indoctrination. Before we get started, I want to share a little bit of my healing journey with you. A little over a year ago, I started heavily processing what I experienced at the Academy at Ivy Ridge. I mean, it's been an ongoing experience, don't get me wrong, but for the last year, it has taken up a lot of my heart and my mind and my time and my energy as I'm working through what I experienced. It was something that I thought I was over, that it didn't bother me anymore. For a long time, I felt like I shouldn't still be bothered by what happened to me. I remember searching for hours on the internet to find someone who could help me process or who could help me understand what happened. I was Googling academic research, looking at universities, looking at scientific studies. Had anyone studied this? Does anyone understand? Is there anyone who will be able to grasp the psychological torture that I went through? And in that moment, I felt such deep despair that there was no one in the world who was qualified to treat me. And what I mean by that is that I really was searching for a deep understanding of the systems and the structure and the manipulation and the abuse that took place in these centers, because it is such a unique experience. And so in that moment, I started searching. I didn't think that there was a word to describe what I and so many others had experienced. But it took a lot more research and time to let my emotions, you know, fall back down to their baseline before I could finally acknowledge the similarities between cultic abuse and the program. Am I saying the program was a cult? I'll let you decide that for yourself. But what I do know is there is an undeniable correlation of experiences of survivors of both groups. If you're on Apple Podcasts, drop a comment in the review section and let me know what you think after you listen. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it too. So just a reminder, this podcast is completely run on donations. So if you'd like to continue hearing survivors' stories and informative episodes with experts in the field of psychology and recovery each week, please make a donation. It is so appreciated. My Cash App details are down in the description. And thank you again to everyone who continues to support this podcast and our mission. Now, let's welcome our guest, Rachel Bernstein. Hello, Rachel. Welcome to the podcast. I am so excited to have you here today. I've been ranting and raving about you, so welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. And thank you for ranting and raving. I don't know what you said, but yes, thank you for whatever it was. So yes, I'm very happy to be talking to you about this subject and others.
Yes. And we were speaking a little bit before we started recording, but as survivors of this community, I think all of us at this point are looking for someone who can help guide us through this healing process. So I'm really excited for the knowledge that you will bring to this interview. So you are a cult recovery specialist.
Right.
So tell us, how did you get interested in that? How did you get involved in that? I mean, that is such an obscure thing to be like, that's what I want to do with my life. So tell us your story a little bit.
Okay. Yeah, that is kind of an interesting thing. And I know that it's different. It's definitely different. And what we'll probably talk about today is how it's different and how it's also the same, in that everyone can be manipulated at different times in their lives. And so this is actually something that affects everybody, but to varying degrees, because some people have it in a relationship and some people had it in their family system growing up. And sometimes people got it in a cult or a teen treatment place. So how did I get involved? So I had a sibling who, I still do have a sibling, but she got hooked into Scientology. And this was before, you know, there was accessibility to information and the internet, actually. And so, while the internet has done a lot for cults because it does a lot of cult recruiting, it also has done a lot for people who have been in cults because it offers a lot of really good, valuable information and counter information from what you're being told by the leader about what's true about the group, which is extremely valuable. So our family sort of rallied around my sibling to try to figure out what was going on. And at first, you know, we could tell there were some personality changes and her bank account was, you know, at a zero balance suddenly. And she was giving over everything to this group that she really knew nothing about. The turning point there was that she said that the reason she was so open to it because the friend who got her involved said, oh, you know, now I know how to get along with my parents so much better and we have such a wonderful relationship. And so my parents said, can we call your parents and find out about this wonderful relationship? Because if it turns out it's a good thing, you know, it's fine with us.
Sure. Yeah.
And right. Cause we didn't know about, you know, fine, if it works, it works kind of thing. And my parents were open. So they called her parents and the parents said, where have you seen our daughter? Where we don't know where she is.
Oh my God.
And it was this moment where we just got chills. This was how the group defined getting along better with your parents. She was just 17. And so actually it scared my sister that you could redefine what a relationship is, that sometimes it's no relationship, but she was taught to do something that's a Scientology term, which is to handle. She was taught to handle those relationships, and that's how she was handling them. So that kind of opened our eyes to the fact that there were these people out there who not only individually could lie to people, because we know there have been snake oil salesmen since forever, but that huge groups could be doing this to people and getting away with it and getting tax exempt status as a church and whatever else, and getting government funding to do this. So then when I went on to study education, I was studying to be a special ed teacher, which I became. And then I thought, I want to become a therapist. So I went right into grad school to become a therapist. And I suddenly remembered how we couldn't find anybody to help us, to help her, because the programming had already set in a bit. And it took a long time to undo it. And if only we had had somebody who knew how to help her go through those stages, things would have really gone faster and she would have gotten back on her feet faster. And so I thought, well, I don't know if there are books that teach people how to do this. I found a few, but, you know, maybe there are conferences, maybe there are people to learn from, but because we couldn't find a resource, maybe I need to be that resource. And so that's how it started. And then I met a couple others who do the same work. And there's still just a few of us. And there need to be more, because the need is much greater than the amount of people there to help out.
Absolutely. And it's fascinating to me how these groups can get us to go against everything that we feel intuitively. And it can be packaged in a way, and I call it almost like a Trojan horse. Like, it's packaged in a way of like, you're going to handle your relationships. This is great. It's going to be a great thing. Meanwhile, you're actually having the exact opposite happen. And this is the, you know, contradiction that we find. So, you know, cults are especially dangerous, and I know you know this, but it's because they don't necessarily say, hey, we're a cult. Right. They're not like, you know, come join us. We're a cult. It's going to be great. You're going to be estranged from everyone. You'll love it. Right. And so oftentimes we really have to dig deeper, and in conjunction with kind of that Trojan horse theory, we have to really look at the layers. So can you tell us, what are some of the key components or red flags of a cult?
Yes, I will absolutely get into that. And what you're saying is that cults say that they're not cults. In fact, some cults will actually say, fine, so we're a cult. So what, you know, you look up cult in the dictionary, you know, they kind of try to get there first. But so I sometimes tell people not to use the cult word, because it just sometimes gets you nowhere with cults, because they have all these ready packaged answers already, you know, for you. Right. But yes, I had a client years ago who said to me, I thought this was going to be something that was going to help me get through school, because it was on my college campus, and deal with stress and meet friends. If only the brochure had told me exactly what it was, then I would never have gotten involved. And I said, if the brochure had told you exactly what it was, what would the brochure have said? And he said, hey, we're a group of people who are going to lie to you from the start, and we're going to do it because we were told to do it. In fact, we might be nice people, the members, but we're just going to say whatever we need to say in order to be in good grace with the leader who we know is watching us. And so we're also going to be your really, really good friends and community until you question anything or until you decide to leave. And then we will drop you and we will defame you, and it will be like you never existed. So all the people you will have sacrificed in your life for are the relationships with us, like your family and friends. You'll have nowhere to go then after the cult, because we're going to drop you and you're going to feel like you burned your bridges. And then he said, and then you're going to leave feeling like you don't know if you can ever trust yourself again, because you put your trust in the wrong people. And then you're going to feel really handicapped in your life. So, hey, you want to come to our meeting? you know?
Right, join us Wednesday at 7. We'll,
yeah. Exactly. We'll serve drinks. So yeah, it's right. I mean, but they're not going to say that, but that is often what happens. And so, you know, and we're going to destroy your ego. We're going to everything else. So here are the red flags. And it's interesting because there was someone on my podcast a couple of weeks ago who heard from somebody else this quote that I want to share with you, which is that if you're in a group that puts rose-colored glasses on your eyes, then red flags just become flags. And I thought that was an amazing quote. So you don't notice them.
I love that.
And yeah. And I don't know who said it originally, and I want to be able to give this person credit. So if anyone's listening who knows who said that, that I just want to, it's amazing.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So one of the red flags is that you are not able to get answers to your questions. People will sometimes say, okay, but how long am I going to be staying here and what's going to be happening? And trying to find out, you know, and it's going to be turned back on you. Why are you being so, you know, hesitant? Why are you being so nosy? Why are you seeming afraid of us? Why are you trying to find out things before you need to find them out? You just can't get the answer. Mm-hmm. Or you'll see, or it will become clear. You know, those are the times you need to just leave if you can. And also, if parents are arranging for their kids to be in some, parents need to actually pull out of this whole thing if they can't get an answer to their questions. And if it's turned back on them that there's something wrong with them for even questioning the group. So can't get an answer. If you notice also that there is a lot of deception. The thing that you're being told just don't quite come together because a lie is much harder to remember than the truth. So you have cult leaders and people who run horrible organizations who lie rampantly. And we have it, you know, a lot of people are talking about our government in this way. And depending on what you, which side you think is doing it more, whatever, just government, I'll just say that, be nonpartisan. But what is important is that you are going to notice discrepancies. You're going to notice that on Monday, something was okay and something was said. And on Tuesday, now it's different. And some behavior is okay one day, and then it's crucified basically the next day. And you're not supposed to question that, that somehow that all makes sense within the group. But also, again, because you're told that if you're questioning anything or if you're having a hard time with anything, there's something wrong with you, then you stop questioning. The other thing is that people are singled out to be on the hot seat. That's the behavior modification within cults. So there's a ton of public shaming. If you've done something wrong to them, or if you're showing any independence, or if you're showing that you're having some critical thinking, if you're showing that you're having these skills and strengths that threaten a narcissist, that threaten someone who wants overall control, you'll be singled out and called whatever bad thing fits in with the group. If it's a religious group, you're of the devil, you're a heathen. If it's not, whatever, they'll diagnose you away. But it's a way to keep people in line because the hot seat is a horrible place to be within a cult, and it can last a very long time. And all the work that you've done to raise yourself up to a certain place where people can like you and trust you will all be lost. And you have to climb up back from square one. So you don't get any points. You know, you don't accumulate points. They can be knocked out as soon as they want. And then the other thing is that within a cult, the rules only apply to the followers, but not to the leaders, not to the people in charge. Mm-hmm. So they can do whatever they want. They can say whatever they want, but the people who they are controlling can't, for example, have any partners, but the leader can be sleeping with 12 people. They can't have access to any of their funds, but the leader has, you know, 4 homes. And so there's this discrepancy. That's this wild discrepancy, and usually having to do with how much freedom you have. And then one more thing that I think is a really important point, which is that usually these groups operate independently. So there's no one to go to complain, to say, hey, is this right that this is happening here? Because there's kind of no governing body. Communication stays in-house. So they'll tell you if you're having trouble, you can complain to someone, but in the organization, that never goes well for you. And then because there's so much secrecy and you're told to keep things secret within cults, which is another red flag, that's how they get away with what they get away with for so long, then you can have people who live right next door to a horrible place and they'll have no idea what's happening. And you'll also be told that if you go to the police, they won't believe you. If you go to your parents, they won't believe you. Mm-hmm. So you feel like you have zero protection after a while and you just give up.
Everything that you just said, I'm thinking about my experience at the WASP program, and I'm in my mind going, check, check, check. And I know probably every other survivor who's listening to this is feeling the same way. If we ever questioned the program or had any kind of resistance, we were told that we're not working the program, that we were being defiant, even just questioning things, we're arguing, we're manipulating. They had primed all of our parents that if we were to say anything at all negative, we were lying and manipulating. Mm-hmm. And we were just trying to get home and we were running the same old patterns and we would be right back at home manipulating them. So there was that aspect of fear of if you don't keep your child in this program, they're going to die or be in jail. And so they had really just capitalized on those insecurities and desperation of parents who, were really seeking help for their children.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I think also, these groups make people, the victims, have to be under the microscope and have to judge or wonder about their own kind of core and character. And that's just a total redirection. That's a deflection away from the people who are controlling you, who are the manipulators. Because if you can be seen as the manipulator, then the eyes are on you and not on the person who's actually manipulating you.
It's so fascinating because as I research now as an adult and I listen to different depositions and different investigations that have been done over the years, I'm like, you guys are manipulating the heck out of everyone else. And so it's just a very interesting conundrum to be in.
Yes.
So you had kind of touched on this a few moments ago. You said, I don't really like to use the word cult. And so I know we're also kind of trying to find a language that properly identifies what we've been through. And I naturally feel like by using the word cult that it creates a sense of disbelief or questioning, or it just doesn't sound very credible. What are your thoughts on that?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. It's an interesting word because there are a lot of people who will say that these were the arguments we had, that I had loved ones saying you're in a cult. And then I was just taught what to say if someone told me I was in a cult. So, that just it's a conversation that doesn't go anywhere. And, cults will say, fine, look up cult in the dictionary. And cult is just defined in the dictionary usually as like a sect and a group that's independent and different. And so it doesn't really define what we're talking about. And yes, it does unfortunately make people think, how could you fall for that? And suddenly have you be the one who's being questioned as opposed to the attention being on the puppet masters, basically. And so I think while you can use the word cult, if you offer a definition, then that's fine. If you let people just think, like Charles Manson or I don't know, whatever they have in their heads, that is their frame of reference that doesn't really fit the situation, then they're going to get lost in filling in the blanks themselves. And they're going to get kind of misinterpretation of what you went through. So I think for places like your former awful place and others, there are other terms that can be used. They are to a great degree like re-education camps. They are places of great abuse that goes unchecked. And so using the legal language that I think is recognizable about it being abusive a place of harassment, intimidation, neglect. There's a way to weave those words into the definition, then you have people really understand it. And also that because those are legally recognized terms, then you give the impression, which is true, that they were doing things that they should be arrested for.
Right. It becomes even more specific about the actual experience there instead of putting some kind of label on it. And I almost hope that we don't even have to get to a point where we can put a label on it. I hope that it ends quickly enough that it doesn't become defined in that kind of a way.
Great. That'd be really great.
So in your response, you had said when people start using words like cult, a lot of people start questioning, like, well, were you stupid? Why? How did you fall for that? I would know the signs. I would never fall for anything like that. I would know immediately. So what do you think makes cults so effective in being able to retain their members?
Part of what cults do that is so effective is that they have a face that's used for the public. And it's extremely different, in fact, the opposite, behind closed doors. And again, because a lot of these groups, not all, but a lot of them are run by this pathological narcissists and sociopaths. That's how they are in the world. They can be charming. They can look just fine. They can seem solicitous and sweet and caring. And then from their former partners, they'll say, as soon as I heard the key in the door, my heart sank and I kind of broke out into a sweat because I knew the monster was home. So that's what helps them get away with so much. And I think also because they tell people to keep things secret, just like abusers do. You know, this will be our secret. And if you tell anyone, you'll get hurt or the people you care about will be harmed in some way. But I think that, unfortunately, because of the language they use, they sound legit and they seem helpful. And they're helping people who can't really function in society. And this is going to help them function in society. So they're seen as these kind of benevolent organizations that are doing the hard work for you. You know, they're kind of getting your loved ones back on their feet. And so there are a lot of parents who feel relief and sometimes don't look any further because they just feel relief. They were worried about their child or it was becoming too much, or the parents themselves were just easily overwhelmed people. And so, you know, they want someone else to take care of it. Cults, other kinds of cults really get away with it also when they are religiously based because they hide behind God and being spiritual. And whenever people from cults, when they're interviewed, they seem like very calm, you know, very put together professional people. And the members are also taught to put on a show. Mm-hmm. It's like when you hear these awful stories of, you know, people from the Red Cross coming into concentration camps. And that's on that day, they made sure to give some of the people breakfast or a meal at all and have them wear clean clothes and have to say, you know, that everything was fine here. And so it's all for show. And it's a true crime. And yes, it does still happen. And there was a client of mine who was having trouble with his daughter who was kind of acting out and not listening to rules and climbing out the window at night and seeing friends. And he said, oh, we found this place that can help her kind of get back into, you know, being in charge of herself. And they're going to actually help us with getting her there. And as soon as I heard that, I thought, she's going to get kidnapped. Like, you know, you don't, if you're sending your child somewhere where you think it's going to be good for them, you probably don't need help with getting them there. And so I said, what does that mean? Help? Well, someone's going to come by, you know, maybe tonight. And I said, someone she knows? No, no. Someone you know? No. So, okay. Well, so she'll be traumatized forever from that experience. And won't ever trust you again. I'm just letting you know. And he said, what are you talking about? I said, how much research have you done? Not just looking at their website, not just talking to people on the staff, but talking to people who have left, talking to people who have complaints, talking to people who have been too afraid to talk for a long time, but have finally told their stories, talking about lawsuits, all of those sorts of things. And he went the other research, not just calling them to find out if they were legit. And it was amazing. And this was just about 2 months ago here in LA. So it happens a lot, way too often.
It does. And we see, even in our community, parents will contact us and they'll say, oh my gosh, I'm so grateful that I found you guys, because I was just getting ready to send my son, daughter, niece, nephew, a friend's child, whoever, to a program. And I'm so grateful that we found this information. And it's just surprising to me how trusting we can be when someone comes in and claims that they can fix all of our problems. You know, now we kind of know, maybe a decade or two ago, we didn't so much, but we'd see advertisements on TV for weight loss. Mm-hmm. And it was like, if you drink this drink, you're going to lose 30 pounds in 72 hours. Right. Mm-hmm. And they were making sales and people were like, you know, take my money. I want that, please. I need to lose weight. And I feel that it's the same now with people's children, in a sense. Mm-hmm. Send us your kid. You'll have peace of mind. And we'll take care of the rest. You relax at home. We'll take care of the problem child. And then we know how that goes.
Yeah. Right.
So what are some of the most common psychological effects that you see from people coming out of either these programs or coming out of cults? I know our survivor community, there's so many of us who are putting together the pieces and just trying to understand what happened to us. Mm-hmm. Mentally, emotionally, mm-hmm. spiritually, even, and also how that's gone on to affect us since, because mm-hmm. I know there's a lot of us who have continued to go through other trauma or be in abusive relationships, which mm-hmm. has a very similar dynamic. So can mm-hmm. you explain, what do you see in your practice with people coming out of these groups?
Right. So I see a lot of after effects. I see a lot of trauma, and something. So to go back to something you said and to tie it into this answer is that when people are told, you know, we'll take care of your problems, within cultic groups, they feed off of you having the need for them. And so if you come in and you really don't have a problem, they will create your problem. So they will convince you or convince your loved ones that you have problems, that you have anger management issues, that you are an addict, that you're a lot of things. You will get diagnoses that are probably not ones that fit you, or fit you a bit, but are an over exaggeration, mm-hmm. or are caused by being in a place like that. So people who are mistreated, and people who are lied to, or people who are not believed, or people who are suddenly ostracized and that they have to work to have people there trust them again, or they're dealing with food deprivation and sleep deprivation, they're not going to be able to have control over their emotions. And then when they lose it, or they start crying, or they get aggressive, they will then be looked at like, see, yep, they have all these problems. See, and now it's just coming out. Well, no, it's not that it's coming out. It's that you cause them.
You're creating this.
Right. So they're generating their necessity and to get more power over you, to get more money out of you, whatever it is that drives them. And there are some cults that are not about money. They really are just about power. The ones that are kind of communally living, but they can convince people to have a lot wrong with them. And so one of the things that I deal with a lot is people saying, I don't know if this thing is a thing. Like, I don't know if this diagnosis that I'm dealing with and getting help with or being medicated for is actually really my problem, because the medication seems to be not helping, or it's making me feel worse. And that's because they don't have that problem. And, but it worked for the group to have them be convinced, or to have other people be convinced that they had that problem. So that's one thing, just trying to figure out what is true about that person and what isn't, and which diagnoses and insults and sort of character flaws that they've been told they have are real and which ones aren't, and making kind of a division between the two, like a column, true, not true. And then helping people understand why they were told those things, how that worked for the organization, why they were controlled in that way, why they were lied to in that way. People also leave feeling a sense of fear. They've usually been in an environment that's quite intense, whether it is that they are being physically abused or it's just so intense that they just have to keep working and doing things around the clock and proving their allegiance and whatever else. And that if they don't do it, something bad will happen. Either they'll get punished in the group or God will notice and punish them. But they have this constant racing heart that releases adrenaline then all the time. Mm-hmm. And they are hypervigilant because they have to be. So it's hard to turn that off when you come out of a group because it's like putting on armor because there was a war and now the war is over. But you're not sure if you should take your armor off yet. Like, should you, do you still need to be vigilant? Is someone still going to come around the corner and, you know,
I feel like you read my diary or something before we came on here.
I didn't know. I really didn't because I didn't know you had one. So, right, sure. Right. I guess it's the important message is these are common reactions. And then knowing if you can trust yourself, because a lot of these groups will tell you, you can't trust yourself. If you could, you wouldn't have needed to be here or you wouldn't have been searching for something like this. So people really will think that either that they're bad people or that they're, if they do something, they're going to do it to excess, or they then live these very kind of small lives, I want to say, without wanting to take too many chances, without making too many friendships, and they get very isolated. So that's just to name a few of the things that I deal with them, and also shame. Because there is so much questioning of the victim when people come out and tell their story. And so by the time people come to talk to me, they've often been shamed, either not believed or been asked that question. What is it about you? Or what is it about your family that made you not notice something I would have noticed right away?
Right.
Which is not true. But for whatever reason, people feel they need to posture. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot. It's a lot of after effects and a lot of needing help just getting back on your feet.
Yeah, it definitely is. And you had said something at the beginning of that question that got me thinking. So when we were in this program, they did two basic things, and I mean, plus a ton more, but I'm just going to focus on these two things that they did upon students arriving. And they would, first thing, have the parent write a commitment letter to the child saying, I am committed to you being here. You cannot manipulate me and you have to graduate. And they were pressured to write this commitment letter, pretty much stating that I'm not pulling you. You're stuck there. This is it. Right. Don't even try. And then the second thing they would do is they would have us write a confession letter. But in this confession letter, we're supposed to tell our parents every single time we told a lie, every time we did anything. And so a lot of times there were children who were sent there because they talked back or because they had an attitude or their parents didn't like how they dressed. There were a few children who had experimented with drugs or, but it was definitely not common. And even then, of course, this wouldn't be the approach to treat that. What would happen is if we gave them a confession letter that they decided that's not extreme enough, they would literally tear it up and they would say, go write it again. And so then we end up having a bunch of children who are falsely confessing to things like, you're right, mom and dad, I am a cocaine addict. You've been right, you know, this whole time. I was also having sex with lots of people and just really exaggerating. But I also think because we had to play that charade for so long, not only to our parents and to staff, but some of us started to really believe that about ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Right. And that most definitely can happen. And it's really sad when that happens because it's hard to undo that. It's not impossible, but it takes some time. because you wonder, you know, I'll have people sitting in my office, well, now with COVID on screen, and I'll think, why do they think that there's so much wrong with them? They seem actually okay to me, but they're pretty sure that, again, they can't be trusted, or that they've done horrible things, or that they've shamed their family or whatever else. I mean, people who also go to these places or are sent to these places because they're gay or trans, or and that's just a crime to their family. And the conversion therapy places, that's a whole other show. That's horrific and needs to, all of those need to be shut down immediately. And so the idea, though, that your parents had to sign something, this commitment letter, and you had to write this confession letter, which had to be embellished. Everyone is being made to do something that makes them have to show they're committed to this, and that they now have said something to each other or to others. That's a technique of influence. Mm-hmm. When you can get somebody to say something, they then feel like they have to back it up. And when a parent has made a commitment or a promise, they think it's the honorable thing to keep to that promise.
Right.
And what gets lost is, what are they saying yes to, and what are they signing off on? And also, if the confessions that you're needing to make are at all true or just a bit true, but, you know, you've had to wildly exaggerate them. There's a Bible-based group that's been around for a long time where they have the members immediately do something called a sin study, reminding me of what you're talking about. So you need to sit down with your discipler and write down everything you've ever done that could be a sin, everything you've ever thought that could be a sin, everything you did do that could be wrong, everything you didn't do and you should have done, just everything. And if the list isn't long enough, they will say, well, what about this? Did you ever have someone, a friend, get something that maybe you thought even for a second, it's too bad, I would like something like that? Oh, well, that's envy. And that's jealousy. And then you have to do a whole envy jealousy list. And it's just so that by the end, you have hundreds of things. And again, like exactly what you're saying, you think, wow, I'm really a terrible heathen. I'm so glad I'm at this place that can keep me in line, because clearly I'm a bad person. And it's so wrong and it's so rampant. And you see a lot, like, this is why I do a former member support group for people in different groups, because they'll do a lot of this, like, head nodding, like, mm-hmm. We called it this in our group, but that's exactly the same thing.
Yeah. So right? Exactly, because as you were explaining that, I was thinking about, you know, part of these programs is we had to attend these seminars. And this was a part of our process to be able to go home. Mm-hmm. And so there was this process that they had, and they had all these, they had a huge wall in this big conference room and just hundreds of pieces of tape stuck to the wall. And they would have you stand on this line and they would say a statement like, mm-hmm. you know, I think that I'm a whore. I think I'm fat. My parents don't love me. I'm a disappointment, right? And they would say all these things. Mm-hmm. And as you identified with each one, you would walk across the room and you would go get a piece of tape and stick it onto yourself. And mm-hmm. so by the end of it, you're covered in you know, all of this disappointment and just judgments against yourself. Yeah. So it's just so wild.
That is so wild. And it's exactly about this public shaming and also literally labeling yourself. And then you think you're doing it to yourself, and you will forget in those moments that actually this whole scene has been manufactured.
Right.
And they're wanting you to label you. So you think, oh, well, this is how I see myself. And so then I'm going to be more open to getting help with that. Because they already wrote what was on the tape, right? So they already came up with the label. So they're labeling you. But because you're putting it on yourself, you think you're doing it. And it's very, unfortunately, clever. A lot of these things are way too clever, and I wish they were not.
Right.
Because you don't see in the moment you don't have, you're in it, right? So you can't, you don't have the vantage point to be looking around and saying, what is going on? Let me take in this whole scene. Because there's also a lot of pressure, I'm sure, that if somebody's there and they don't get, put a piece of tape on themselves, right, that would be horrible.
Oh, right.
So what would happen? I'm curious about that. So what would happen if people seem like, no, none of those fit, or I only have one tape thing on me? What would happen then?
Sure. So what they would do in that situation is they would actually probably bring the seminar to a halt, and they would call your name, and they would stand you up in front of everybody. And then they would essentially tear you apart, and they would say, you know, why do you think that you're better than everybody else? How is this a reflection of your life? You, you know, you're not being real with us. You're not being honest with us. You think that, you know, and really start attacking. Mm-hmm. And then what they do is they would ask everybody else in the seminar to give this person feedback. Mm. And essentially, feedback could be anything, but as long as you said it and they have phrases, and I almost don't want to re-traumatize anyone, yeah. But they would have a certain format that you would give feedback in. But within that format, you could say absolutely anything you wanted to this person. And the facilitator would be there saying, yes, yes. And in fact, participating in that feedback was one of the ways that you got through the seminar. That was another reason. If you weren't giving people feedback, they could stand you up, and then you would be, you'd be in the hot seat.
Wow. Incredible. Incredible. Right. And stopping that, I'm sure for some people, they were happy that someone had stopped this from happening. Because sometimes in those situations, it becomes sort of Lord of the Flies. Like, you're happy someone else is on the hot seat because it, you know what it's like to be on it. And then you can feel guilty about being happy that it's not you. So a lot of people with good consciences actually feel very guilty about having been happy about that. And they leave feeling very bad about themselves because of it, even though they were put in that situation. Bringing everything to a halt was probably interpreted, I'm assuming, as your behavior is stopping other people from, you know, having their moment, their growth, their whatever.
Was that? Oh, yes.
Okay.
Spot on. They would say that almost to the T. You know, look at you. You're not being considerate of anybody else in this room. They are here dedicated. Yeah, exactly.
So entertaining. Yeah.
It, when you said that, that kind of took me aback for a second. I'm like, she knows. That's what they would do. Exactly. So it's taken us about 15 years, what we've noticed. It's about a 10, 15 year time frame in order for people to really start unpacking the trauma that they experienced. So do you have any kind of explanation of that? And is there like an average amount of time that survivors must go through before they can start looking at the trauma or facing what happened?
So sometimes it depends. When people ask me how long will it take until I get better, there are a lot of factors, and then I'll answer your question about why it takes so long, but there are a lot of factors that are woven into that equation. So one is your wiring. There's some people who, because they are more sensitive, things impact them more. They tend to be more empathic. They just sensorily, they're more sensitive. So that whole experience is awful to them on a much more grand scale than other people who can kind of let things slide a bit or let things roll off their shoulder a little bit more. Then what adds to it is the kind of trauma you went through. If it was emotional, if it was sexual, if it was physical, if it was that you were held in isolation and had to be with your own thoughts at the time, which does a number on people. And I think about that in the prison system and what that does to people. So the nature of the abuse and how multiple it was in terms of how many abuses you went through also adds to the amount of time. But I think when people come out, they're not cult experts just because they were in one. They don't know what happened to them. they can't say, they don't know what that thing is called that happened to them or that technique that used. And so they don't have the language to express it. So they are usually just staying pretty silent about it, because they'll say what I hear a lot when I ask people to tell me their story, they'll say, I don't know where to start. And part of that is because, do I start before it happened? Do I start with what's happened to me after? Do I start with all the thousands of horrible experiences I had while I was there? Do I start with just trying to explain it, but maybe there's another way to explain it, and maybe I'm not interpreting it right because I was made to doubt my own interpretation of things? So there's a lot that delays people in getting help. And also because sometimes people have tried and they've gone to a therapist who's said, oh, I know that you're probably, you know, you're just unhappy that you needed to be sent somewhere that, you know, blah, 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 whatever. So that didn't go well. And then people shut down, and or they've told someone and someone has judged them or judged their families, and they don't want that. And that's not helpful. I think what also delays it is not wanting to re-traumatize yourself by needing to talk about it. Because if you're still in a fragile state, you can't actually, in terms of systemically, you can't tolerate having to dredge it all up, because you will have just been happy that you had your first night in 5 years without a nightmare. And so you might not want to tell the stories because the nightmares will come back. So you're having to kind of keep yourself in a safe space. And sometimes that also delays getting help.
I know for myself, I had gone through an experience about a year ago, and I've been processing my experience within the program probably for about the past 4 or 5 years ish. But very diligently for the past year. And so last year, as I started diving back into it, I actually was going through my medical file, and I was going through all of my letters that I had written while I was there and all of the letters I had received while I was there. And so listening how I started changing in the beginning, I'd say for probably the first 9 months, most of my letters were, Mom, I'm so lonely here. This place is not for me. It's not helping me. I'm so tired of the staff yelling at us. And I think I also had a very difficult time of expressing what was happening there. But I knew that I felt trapped, and I knew that it wasn't somewhere that I wanted to be. And so as I dove back in to all of this, mentally and emotionally, it brought me back to feeling like I was 14. Mm-hmm. And it was funny. It's funny in hindsight. Maybe this is the trauma talking. I don't know. But I was starting a new job the next week, which was a very high level position. I was working in state government. I really had to be 30. Like there was no way I could walk into the office feeling like I'm this 14 year old again. And so I've heard that from many survivors. So do you feel like with trauma, if there's any kind of like age regression or mental and emotional regression when we start to unpack things like that?
Right. I think that, and I mean, to add to the problem also, as I'm thinking about it, people who have been in cults that have had a psychotherapy component to it and a group therapy component to it are terrified of going for therapy or going to a support group. And so in my support group and in my work, I have to do a lot of reassuring and sometimes do therapy with the door open whatever helps people feel comfortable. But I think, yes, there is something regressive about a lot of these groups. And again, they benefit from your regression because then they can be the parent and they can be in charge of you and they can say, see, you know, you are getting out of control. So when you go back into this very kind of emotional, kind of primally emotional state, you go back to what it feels like to be an adolescent who has a lot of emotions and doesn't know how to contain them and is just feeling a lot of things all at once and also hasn't really yet developed you know, self-confidence, et cetera, you can go back into that state and feel like you're not worthy of things, or that someone is going to see, like if you're walking into a government job position, that someone might think you're a fraud and they're going to notice you're not, you know, really an adult, et cetera. So,
yes. I'm 5'3 as it is. So I feel like, you know, that didn't really help my case with
you. No, it did not help. Right, yeah. Right. Yes. Right. So, I mean, at any height, you want to be able to walk tall, right? Right. You want to be able to walk into a room feeling confident. And the groups like this will take that away from you, because otherwise they can't control you and manipulate you because you're going to be too strong for them. And also, sometimes the stronger you are, the harder they work to break you. Mm-hmm. They really have to get you into a regress state where you're kind of flailing around emotionally. And it's horrible. It really, again, should be a crime.
And I think we saw that a lot within these programs, that when people would dig their heels in or stand up for themselves in any kind of a way, not even necessarily inappropriately, but maybe they just asserted themselves, then the abuse would become physical and they would physically restrain and isolate these students. So then that was always the fear of, okay, well, I need to comply because I don't want to end up like Sarah down in isolation. Mm-hmm. Then on top of that, I'll just add this last little punctuation. They would threaten to send us out of the country specifically to either High Impact, which was a horrible, horrible facility in Mexico, or they would send us to Jamaica, where they would let us know there's no child labor laws there to protect you. And so at 14, 15, 16, many of us were in that age range, although there were some that were younger and some that were older. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was a huge threat, and who knows what would happen to us there. Mm-hmm. So can you give any recommendations of how can people start to heal? Are there any methods? Are there anything that you would recommend to survivors on how to process this?
Yeah, I do. One is to connect with each other. And it's great that you are part of a forum that is helping people connect. I get contacted by a lot of people who think they're the only ones, you know, and the only ones who went through that, and the only ones who have left a particular group. And that's never the case. Or the only ones who couldn't cut it, or the only ones who were unhappy with it. A lot of, in these groups, a lot of people are just faking being okay. Mm-hmm. And so when you're unhappy, you think you're the only one. You're probably part of the majority. You just don't know it. So I think, yes, connecting with other people who have left your particular group or a group like it is extremely helpful. Also, not being judgmental of yourself, because you were in a space that was so highly judgmental of you that you want to get to a place where you can say there isn't a right way to heal and a wrong way to heal. There isn't the right amount of time. You should be better. All of it is okay, and you are okay, and you want to have sort of this fierce self-acceptance to counter so much of the criticism and, you know, defamation of you and your character. And I think cult education, knowing what happened to you, that these are techniques. You got swept into a well-oiled machine of manipulation. You didn't know it. And when you maybe started to suspect it, it was too late, because you're already in it. And so I think for people to understand what happened to them, why people in charge of these places or these groups, or even within relationships and controlling relationships, why is it that this person is doing this to me? What is wrong with them that makes them do this to me? What disorder do they have that makes them say these things to me or need for me to feel this way about myself? And when you understand that it's not about you, then it really helps you take a lot of these diagnoses off of you and put it back on the where they originated, which is, you know, the controller and the person in charge usually. And I think something else that helps is for families to get educated about what their loved one is going to need during this time. Because sometimes families they've worked really hard to rescue their child, and then they want to have a party as soon as their kid comes home, and the kid is still feeling this great sense of loss, like loss of what this group was supposed to be and the promises and loss of that community. And so they're not ready for balloons to be coming down from the ceiling and, you know, welcome back. Right. So don't do that, parents and loved ones, but also don't sit in judgment of them. Or if it's, I mean, in these kinds of groups, I think you can sit in judgment of the leadership, but with people who have left or who have been kicked out of certain organizations or Bible-based organizations or therapeutic organizations, they are not ready for you to judge it because they think they were the ones who kind of abandoned the group or just weren't strong enough. And they're still going to be wired to be defensive about the leadership and about the group. So just let people talk and just give them a safe space to land. Mm-hmm. And then when you feel like they're ready to find out what other people have been through when they were involved in this group and talk to other former members and really hear the truth about it, then you can share it with them. But just make them feel safe emotionally and also physically. Sometimes also people are very calmed in a multisensory way. And so sometimes talking is good, but sometimes just playing music that, you know, the person used to really like to listen to with you, or baking the thing that, you know, reminds them of a good time at home, and just through smelling it and tasting it, they get reconnected. Mm-hmm. So there are other ways to help people again safely land. And sometimes it's talking and sometimes it's through these other means.
I love that. Thank you. When we can reconnect to our own safety and know that we have that foundation to kind of unravel, right? We know that we can trust and predict what's going to happen in our environment, then we can really start to unfold. Thank you so much. And everyone, definitely go listen to Rachel's podcast, Indoctrination. I will be putting the link to that down in the description. So thank you so much for your time. It has been a pleasure. And we're going to have to get together again because I have so many things that I want to pick your brain about. You're incredible. So thank you so much for giving us all of your time, energy, wisdom. We so appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, right back at you, because I love the work that you're doing and how much education you're providing and how you've had to walk through the fire in order to get there. So kudos to you.
Thank you.